Hello, Susanna Lopez with you from Sisters in Crime, and we bring you a brand new series of Scarlet Stiletto Bites, scintillating short crime fiction stories by our Australian Sisters in Crime authors. Many of us, after a busy career or five, yearn for a sea or a tree change. In today's story, a couple have chosen to run a holiday park in northern Tasmania for the peace and quiet, but find crime is not confined to cities. Check Out Time by Rowena Helston won Best Investigation in Sisters in Crime's 2009 Scarlet Stiletto Awards. It was 10:30 a.m. All the guests who were due to check out had called into reception except the couple in cabin 4. No big deal. They'd paid on arrival the previous afternoon. The man said they'd probably be leaving early, as long as they hadn't kept the key. Ray Cameron pushed herself up from the reception desk. The wings of flesh jiggled under her arms. Lately, she'd noticed the drooping skin had begun to pucker. Over 50 and it was all downhill from here. Outside, the clouds were starting to break up as the buffeting breeze whipped the sky. The yard was littered with fallen gum leaves, damp from recent rain and springy underfoot. She could already see the car was gone from beside cabin 4. In the distance, past the perimeter of the holiday park, the waves were choppy in Bass Strait. The key glinted in the door of the cabin. Good, they must have read the reminder notice on the fridge. The curtains were tightly drawn, as if the couple had risen when it was still dark. Ray turned the key and pushed the door ajar, releasing the bottled-up remnants of old cooking fumes. The contents of the cabin were askew, like an earth tremor had rippled through in the night. The padded vinyl chairs were pulled out crookedly from the table for two. A jumble of spare blankets and pillows had fallen from the open closet onto the floor, blocking the path to the ensuite bathroom. On the double bed against the nearest wall was a mound of bedding, but it was not quite the casual mess that it seemed at a glance. There was something elongated beneath it. Then Ray spotted the pale toes protruding over the edge of the mattress, the delicate button toes of a woman with glimpses of purple-chipped nail polish. An echo sounded from the dripping tap over the miniature kitchen sink. Ray bent closer to the fawn velour bedspread. She knew she had to be sure before raising the alarm. Heart thumping, she pinched the bedspread and pulled softly, far enough to see the gaping mouth. It was the same woman who checked in the previous afternoon, a small, wispy creature with untamed hair and a vague expression. Ray encircled the cold wrist, pressed firmly, and waited for a pulse. But there was nothing. She locked the cabin and hurried across its wooden deck. The breeze swished in the ragged paper bark next to the empty car space. A backpacker was striding in the direction of the laundry block with an armful of washing. Ray put on a brave face and gave him a tight smile. Stacy, the girl who cleaned the cabins, came trundling down the path with her trolley, stacked with clean sheets, towels and toilet rolls. Ray intercepted her and told her to skip cabin 4. Back at reception, she rang the local one-man police station and the call was automatically diverted to Sergeant Bruckner's mobile phone.
"Bob Bruckner,"
he answered gruffly. "It's Raylene from Shearwater Holiday Park."
"How's business?"
His voice boomed above the din of a confined space like a shopping arcade. "Oh, probably about to take a dive. I just found a body in one of the cabins. Dead, I'm afraid." Half an hour later, two detectives arrived from Burnie CIB. Detective Inspector Ogilvie was tall and dark, with quizzical eyebrows
ghostly skin and a thin slash of a mouth. The younger one, Detective Senior Constable Boyd, was stockier, with spiky orange hair and freckles. Ray recognised in their names and faces the Scottish pioneering heritage of many of the locals, including her husband Neil. She led the detectives into the cabin. It looked even smaller, with two beefy men in it. Boyd stood next to the table while his superior poked around. Ray hovered outside the doorway, watching. Could be a domestic and the bloke's done a runner, Boyd suggested. Things disturbed in the struggle? Ogilvy nodded at the open cupboards under the kitchen sink, crockery in disarray. Well, sure, if they're chucking plates at each other, but this looks more to me like someone searched the place, and I don't think they found what they were after. Ogilvy bent over the bed and drew the blanket further back with a plastic-gloved hand, revealing more of the woman's greyish pallor. A few strands of her hair were caught in a crooked tooth. He looked across at Ray. You said you felt for a pulse. Touch anything else? Just a blanket. Anyone else been in here? No. Next, the detectives asked to see the guest records at reception. Ray fished the registration form out of the filing cabinet. The husband's name was Martin Fletcher. Detective Boyd jotted down the contact details provided on the form. Credit card receipts? Said Ogilvy. Ray shook her head. Paid in cash. Do you remember what kind of car he was driving? Ray had only seen the car briefly and could not remember the make or model. It was a smallish sedan or a large hatchback, reddish in colour, I think. Ogilvy said, Well, how would you describe their manner? Did they strike you as typical holiday makers? Not really, she said. I got the impression they were just passing through. They didn't act like tourists, didn't ask about the sights or anything. Only thing he asked me was where he could buy cigarettes last night. Ray detailed what had happened. She'd told Martin that the shop down the road might still be open. He'd come back 20 minutes later, skulking past the window, empty-handed as far as she could see, so she waved him inside. No luck, huh? She'd said to him. He'd wagged his head, sharp face, shrew-like features, the kind of bloke who could turn nasty. I just remembered when you were gone. I've got a pack of ciggies in Lost Property. Have those if you like. Someone left them behind in the laundry, but the price they cost these days, I hung on to them in case the owner came looking. I'm game, he'd said. Ray fetched the cigarettes and showed him the pack, an obscure brand. Beggars can't be choosers, he'd said, reaching out. Thanks. Ogilvy wanted the contact details for all of the guests who had been at the holiday park the previous night but had since checked out. Then the detectives went to interview the longer-staying guests, the campers and caravans, to inquire if they had seen or heard anything suspicious overnight. Secluded in the owner's residence, Ray had not been aware of any disturbance. The forensic team dusted, mapped and photographed their way through and around the cabin. The woman's body was taken away. Ray tried to calm down with a cup of tea. She massaged her fingertips in circles on her temples and slowly rotated her head. Her chin was hanging downwards, accentuating the jowls, when the labourer who was working on the demolition of the old rec room slouched into the office. Oh, just what she needed, some problem with the job. Replacing the dilapidated and hardly used rec room with another paying cabin was her first initiative since Neil died. The labourer hitched up his sagging shorts and crinkled his leathery face to speak. Sorry, love, I've stuck a snag. He led Ray to the rear of the holiday park where the broken shell of the rec room stood. Sheets of corrugated iron roofing leant against the jagged brick walls, awaiting disposal. A wheelbarrow of debris was parked next to a big yellow dumpster. The labourer pushed together a couple of bricks for Ray to stand on. Barking eagerly, the labourer's kelpie darted back and forth. Ray's stomach lurched as she gazed over the edge of the dumpster at the sprawled figure. He was face down, dotted with chunks of rubble. There was something familiar about the straggly hair and the check green shirt. It was the husband from Cabin 4. Ray returned in a numb trance to reception and rang Detective Ogilvy, reading the number off the business card he'd left on the counter. He answered through a mouthful of food. "Oh, sorry, am I interrupting your lunch?" asked Ray. Ogilvy smacked his lips. "Okay, just finishing," she told him the news. The air whistled through his teeth. "Oh, what is it, open season on guests down there?" The police and forensics were still in attendance for the second time when the tourists started arriving back from sightseeing for the day. They gawked at the police vehicles and loitered outside their cabins. A young couple with toddlers drove up to inquire about the rates but decided against staying. As soon as Ray had the chance, she rang her brother-in-law, Lindsay, to fill him in on the situation so it wouldn't be a shock when he arrived to do his shift in the morning. "I'll come straight over," he said. "Nothing to see now," Ray said. The bodies have gone." "Why didn't you call me earlier?" "There wasn't time. It was go, go, go." "What did the police reckon?" "Well, it looks like someone's bumped off the couple and taken the car." "Well, who'd want to do that?" Lindsay asked. "Apparently it's more likely to be someone they knew rather than a random psycho." "That's comforting," he said dryly. "I've been thinking about whether one person could have done it. Killed the husband outside first, then took their time with the wife in the cabin. Or vice versa, found her alone in the cabin, then tracked him down outside." Ray wondered if the husband had gone for a wander to have another cigarette, as the cabins were strictly non-smoking. "How did they die exactly?" asked Lindsay. "The wife was suffocated, with a pillow, I expect. The husband was strangled. There was a mark around his neck, like a groove. But the cops said it wasn't the sort of mark that rope or wire would make. They found a thin type of plastic tubing in the dumpster. Could have been done with that." Lindsay paused to absorb the details. "Well, at least there wasn't a lot of blood to clean up." That night, Ray tried to take her mind off the murders by flipping through magazines until reception shut at 9. "Celebrity mums, best post-baby bodies." Young actresses were photographed in gym outfits and baseball caps, carrying bottles of water. Ray marvelled at the concept of the torso snapping back with taut discipline only 3 or 4 weeks after giving birth. When she had her children, she went up 2 dress sizes, one for each baby, and never regained her former figure. She resolved not to tell her kids about the murders, didn't want to worry them. There was nothing they could do anyway. Brooke was at university in Victoria, and although Grant was closer in Hobart, he always seemed so busy at work. As Ray turned the glossy pages of the magazine, the faces of the victims kept seeping through. Silent, straining mouths. Killed with deliberate stealth. No noisy gunshots, no shrieks between frenzied slashes. Something else nagged at the back of her mind too, piercing the layers of her memory. She located the guest registration form again and stared at it. The combination of letters and numbers it displayed was familiar. Ray hunted further back through the forms in the filing cabinet. 2 weeks, 4 weeks. Bingo! 5 weeks earlier, there it was. The same name, Martin Fletcher. The details were entered in different handwriting, which suggested a different man had filled out the earlier form. Perhaps 2 men using the one alias? Same address, though. 10 Copper Road, Westerton, Tasmania. Same license plates, too. Probably fake. Was Copper A joke about the police, or did it refer to the metal copper? Her own hand had marked paid in cash across the form, meaning that she'd been on duty. It seemed too late at night to ring Detective Ogilvy's mobile, so she faxed the guest form to the number on his card with a covering explanation. Westerton. The name was ordinary enough to sound real, to escape scrutiny, but Ray couldn't find any such location in Tasmania by searching the internet. On the wall was a giant map of the state. She slid along the edge of the counter for a closer look. The name Westerton instinctively drew her attention to the western side of the island. Much of it was uninhabited wilderness. The biggest settlement was Queenstown. It was a mining town, and a further check of the internet confirmed that the copper mine was in full swing. Lindsay arrived the next morning at 7 when Ray was on to her second cup of strong tea, trying to repair the cracks of a restless night. She gave him a tour of the previous day's highlights, pointing out what had happened where. Lindsay folded his arms across his paunch and frowned with concentration at Ray's descriptions. Coming full circle, they stood outside reception. Ray rubbed her eyes. I thought I might go out for a couple of hours, get away from here. Good idea, Lindsay agreed. I can hold the fort. A squad of Rosellas flashed overhead, chirruping. Call me on the mobile if anything comes up, said Ray. The sparkling blue sky augured well for clearing her head. I'll get some exercise, think everything over. She drove a little further up the coast and parked near a headland. A path wound through the coastal heath and rosemary, parallel to the shoreline. Ray followed the track, stopping now and then to scan the undergrowth beside her for partly obscured burrows. The fairy penguins were out fishing for the day, but their telltale droppings near the entrances to the burrows confirmed they would be back, clambering up from the beach after dark. On the return trip, Ray stopped at a pie shop on the outskirts of Shearwater, just for a coffee, skim milk, flat white, no sugar. She blew a dent in the coffee to cool it as she turned the pages of a food-stained copy of The Advocate. Stirring the swirly liquid, her eyes landed on the headline, ATM Gang Strikes East. Police believe that the gang which robbed automatic teller machines last month in Queenstown and Strawn has struck in Orford and Sorrel. The same distinctive method was used to blast the front off each machine. Gas cylinders and plastic tubing were found abandoned at the scene of the latest robbery in Orford. Two words jumped out. Plastic tubing. The dead husband was strangled with something similar. She raced ahead to the reporter's description of an explosive technique called plofkrak, copied from Europe. Small holes were drilled in the front of the ATM and oxygen was pumped into the holes using thin tubes. Ray asked the man at the counter if she could buy the newspaper. He smiled and said, "Oh, take it, I'll only be tossing it out." Ray changed her plans and headed for Burnie instead of home. On the Bass Highway, she chased the speed limit. A logging truck appeared up ahead, and as she gained on it, she heard the advancing whine of a motorcycle. It overtook her and streaked towards the logging truck, triggering a phantom replay of an accident. Superimposed on the scene in front of her, the truck swiped the motorcycle, which skidded, crushing the rider. Logs rolled across the lanes and Neil's oncoming Falcon swerved to avoid a collision. He veered off the road, smashing into a tree. The image froze in the sparkling sunlight. Ray gripped the steering wheel tighter, mouth dry, and pushed on. The Burnie Public Library was a concrete slab of a building. In the newspaper section, Ray backtracked through the previous month's editions of The Advocate until she found the articles, which gave more details about the attacks on the ATMs at Queenstown and Strawn. Ray photocopied the articles for herself and the police. Leaving the library, her mobile phone chimed. Lindsay's voice sounded a little flustered. "Oh, I thought I'd better warn you. The press have swooped like vultures. TV crew from Launceston. Don't talk to them. All I've said is I wasn't here when it happened, which is the truth." "Okay, I'll be back soon," said Ray. "Just one more errand, something I have to tell the police." Detective Ogilvy wasn't in, but his offsider Boyd was available. He pointed to the seats in the empty waiting area and suggested they talk there. Ray showed him the newspaper reports about the ATM robberies and asked if he thought the same kind of plastic tubing could have been used to strangle the husband at the holiday park. Boyd scanned the articles, his brow furrowing. "We're exploring several lines of inquiry. All information received will be taken into consideration," he recited like a media statement. "Have you checked the address for Martin Fletcher?" she asked. "I don't think it exists." "What do you mean?" he said. His eyes were blank blue shields. "I rang the phone number on the guest form and the line was dead. Then I thought Copper Road and Westerton might have some connection with Queenstown. It's in the west and it has a copper mine," Ray explained. Boyd's tone was non-committal. "I'll certainly pass your thoughts on to Detective Inspector Ogilvy." He started to hand back the articles. "No, they're copies for you. By the way, do you happen to know if Detective Ogilvy got my fax?" She recapped its contents. "I wouldn't know about that," said Boyd, roughly folding the photocopies as if they were destined for the bin. Ray left the police station wishing she had phoned Ogilvy instead of turning up without an appointment. Now it would be overkill to call him after just speaking to Boyd, but would Boyd even mention her visit? She bristled on the footpath, clutching her mobile phone. Neil's voice crept into her head. "Simmer down, Dal," he said. "Take a breather." Ray bit her lip and decided to leave it for the time being. On the way home, her son called. He'd seen the news item on the internet at work. "Double murder at a holiday park in Shearwater. Only one place fits that description," he said. Ray pulled onto the side of the road, dodging the furry carcass and smeared entrails of a roadkill victim. She assured Grant she was in no immediate danger. "I'm in contact with the police, and Lindsay's here too." "Let me know right away if you need me," said Grant, a slight quaver coming into his voice. "I will, I promise," she said. The next day, mid-afternoon, when most of the guests were out, Ray was following a guide to desk exercises for busy people. Extend one leg until straight, hold for 5 seconds, lower leg almost to the ground, but stop short, hold for a further 3 seconds. The reception phone rang. Ray dropped her leg and she slid the swivel chair back under the desk to pick up the receiver. It was Detective Ogilvy. He thanked her for the facts and the articles. "We think we might have a lead from some security camera footage near one of the ATMs that was blown up. The images are too grainy to use for ID purposes, but we've got our suspicions about one of the participants." "Sounds hopeful," she said. "We'd like you to come down to the station as soon as possible and look at a photo display, just random shots of ordinary people. See if you recognise anyone." "But it was ages ago that the first man stayed here. I've got no memory of him," said Ray. "Well, you might remember something when you see the photos." There turned out to be 3 batches of photographs to view for 3 different persons of interest, although the cops weren't saying who belonged to which category. Ray was expecting a big book of mugshots, but the photos were all on computer. They appeared one at a time, head and shoulders closely cropped. The subjects looked dazed or defiant. Ray picked the dead husband without any difficulty. The tousled hair, albeit a little longer than when he had visited the holiday park, and the pointy, shrew nose, it was definitely him. But the other bloke, calling himself Martin Fletcher, was more difficult. Photo number 8 stirred something in her memory. Olive skin, loose, dark curls, stubble, busted nose. But she could only say that he looked familiar. She could not specifically confirm that she had met him at the holiday park. The third batch of photos were of women. Prostitutes and druggies and the moles of crooks, Ray surmised. And there she was, the wife, with her mousy hair and shifty eyes, glancing off to one side. It was only when Ray had finished the task that she realised her hands were shaking. She grasped one on top of the other and burrowed them into her lap as Ogilvy came over for some parting words. I wish I could have been more helpful on the second bloke, she apologised. You've done fine. She stood up, clutching her handbag tightly, hoping that would be all for the day. Actually, there's one other thing we really need your assistance with, said Ogilvy. What's that? Well, it's more a matter of getting your approval for an operation we want to run. The trembling started spreading up her arms. Another night of broken sleep. It was the third night of being on standby. Ray went to bed fully clothed. She lay on top of the sheets with a blanket draped over her, just in case she had to get up in a hurry. On the floor next to the bed was Neil's rifle. Drifting in and out, she cursed Ogilvy and Boyd, worried that her guests could be in danger. But the detectives had said it was essential that the place looked occupied, that everything appeared exactly as normal. She lay there and imagined the story spreading like a yellow cloying gas, curling from place to place and mate to mate. In her mind's eye, she saw a police officer, deeply undercover, in the guise of a drug dealer, telling the rumour to his supplier in a pub. The supplier passed the word on to a standover man, who acted as his debt collector, down the line to a bikie at a clubhouse, and then on to a bouncer at a brothel. Ogilvy had admitted to Ray it was a real long shot, but worth a go. Plant the seed. Lay the bait. His instructions to her, if something happened, were to sit tight and stay inside. The sound of shouting jolted her upright. The red glowing digits on the clock radio said 3:18. Ray grabbed the rifle and hurried to the glass sliding door of her cottage, where she could see the action. Commandos from the tactical response group were storming across the yard, dressed in riot gear and helmets and brandishing semi-automatics. Lights snapped on and alarmed faces appeared in cabin and caravan windows. More officers emerged from concealed positions in parked vehicles and a fake camper van. Ray edged out of the sliding door in time to see Ogilvy and Boyd charge from the darkened cabin floor, wearing bulletproof vests. Their boots thudded on the wooden deck. Spotlights ignited to illuminate the scene. And a man squirmed on the ground, small and streaked with dirt. A large torch and a hand spade lay beside him, with more equipment in a nearby kit bag. Another man darted away from the sidelines. Staccato shots crackled on the air, and one of the cops flew backwards, jerking at the shoulder. Officer down. A voice boomed through a megaphone. Drop the weapon, come into the open. Ray rushed back through the cottage, gripping the polished wood of the rifle, barrel pointing downwards. Out the rear door, she crept alongside of the house to end up at right angles to where the shooter had taken cover behind a gum tree. Nobody else had the side-on perspective, although the distance was quite a stretch. The commandos had retreated to drag away the injured officer and regroup. The shooter was rummaging in a pouch around his waist. He kept his pistol raised and one eye on the cops while trying to grapple with something, a pine cone-shaped object. The thought flashed into Ray's mind that it might be a grenade. In one smooth reflex, she flicked the safety catch and raised the rifle. She took aim and fired above his head. Crack! The man jolted with surprise, lowering his pistol. He took a step backwards to regain his balance, one leg protruding beyond the tree. The wild eyes and busted nose from the police photos flashed in Ray's direction, and he saw her, flattened against the wall of the house. He whirled his pistol around, but another gunshot intervened, and this time it came from ahead of him as a marksman struck the leg that was exposed, unprotected by the tree. The Keno numbers danced across the soundless TV screen in the corner of the pub. Ray nursed her flute of champagne, watching the chunk of strawberry bobbing in the stream of bubbles. Ogilvy and Boyd lifted their schooners in unison for a long swig. Ogilvy apologised again for not inviting Ray sooner for a celebratory drink. Oh, we've been as busy as a bunch of blue-tailed flies. I can imagine, she said, remembering their faces disappearing into the scrum of cops on the night and wondering if she would see them again. Ogilvy rolled a drink coaster by its rim across the polished table as he told the story. The dead couple were Justin and Janine Stoppel, gang members. After the last spate of ATM robberies, they intended catching the ferry from Devonport to Melbourne to hide out until things died down. Hence the attraction of a quiet spot on the north coast of Tassie within easy reach of the ferry. But they were double-crossed by the ringleader of the gang, Damien Hardacre, the man in photo number 8. He killed the Stopples at the holiday park in the early hours of the day they were due to catch the 9 a.m. ferry. Took their car and luggage, so it would look like they'd checked out, figuring it might buy him some time before the bodies were found. What he hadn't bargained for was that not all of their share of the cash was there. They'd already got rid of a sizable portion. We know where, from tracing the victim's bank accounts, but Hardacre didn't, said Ogilvy. That's why we tried to send the word to wherever he was holed up, through his mates, smirked Boyd. We were hoping he was greedy enough to fall for it, said Ogilvy. So, what exactly was the rumour? You wouldn't tell me before, said Ray. That we had reason to believe a stash of money had been buried near the cabin. Police were conducting a search, but due to meagre resources, blah, 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 were taking their time and hadn't found anything yet. We weren't guarding the property either, according to this loose-lipped source who knew someone in the force. Ogilvy kept rolling the drink coaster like a cartwheel as he continued. My guess is Hardacre wanted to get rid of the Stopples anyway, dissatisfied with their performance or a falling out over something, we're not sure why yet. He didn't exactly spill the beans in his interview. We're trying to encourage Tiny Tony to roll over. Ray knew from the papers that Tiny Tony was the small man she'd seen squirming on the ground. Real name, Tony Agostini, a former jockey. Did you come up with anything further about Westerton? She asked. Well, as she suspected, it was a fake address inspired by Queenstown, said Ogilvy. Hardacre's little joke. He's from there originally. Used to work in the copper mine till he got the sack. Tell her about Mr. and Mrs. Stoppel, prompted Boyd. Well, they're not Mr. and Mrs., not even de factos, said Ogilvy. Justin and Janine are brother and sister, or they were, I should say. Was she actively involved or just tagging along? Asked Ray. Boyd got in first. She was the cockatoo. It took Ray a second to recall the term from her repository of slang. Ah, the lookout, she said. Janine kept watch while the blokes blew up the ATMs. Then when they were ready to bolt, she drove the getaway car, said Ogilvy. He picked up his beer but stopped short of taking a drink. Bloody good driver too, from what I gather. Checked her record and there's not so much as a parking ticket. Back at the holiday park, Ray savoured the night before going inside. She could hear the whoosh of the waves against the nearby rocks. Stars were peppered over the silvery water. The guests were nestled inside the cosy spaces of their cabins and caravans, behind the soft glow of covered windows. A deep sigh unrolled from Ray's chest and hovered on the air. She was tired of messing with other people's lives. Tomorrow she would contact her kids and see which of them could make time for a visit from her first, Grant down in Hobart or Brooke in Victoria. She had not seen either of them for too long. Neil's voice chimed in. Not such a big hassle to get someone to fill in for a few shifts. All right, she would have a chat with Lindsay. Some of his family had helped out in the past, and then she could head off, north or south. She didn't mind which. The end. Thanks for listening to these Sisters in Crime award-winning stories. Our long-suffering volunteer production manager, Tim Coy, is about to move on to another chapter of his life. We are so grateful to Tim for his time and his technical expertise. So until we find a replacement techie, new crime stories will be on pause. But please do keep sharing the podcast and send any feedback to admin@sistersincrime.org.au. Susanna Lobes, signing over and out for at least a few weeks.